morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, for any of you out there who are Catholic and divorced and perhaps searching for answers about dating, remarriage, and where you might stand with the church, our first guest this morning can provide many of those answers, and that she has done in her third book titled The Catholic Guide to Dating After Divorce, which is published by Ave Maria Press. Lisa Duffy, many thanks for being with us on the show today.
Pat, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, there was a time in the church when divorced Catholics were considered something of outsiders, or at least people who had severely limited options for the future. What's changed?
Well, I think some things have definitely changed, and that is that divorce among Catholics is a growing crisis in the church. With the no-fault divorce laws making divorce so easy, Catholics are divorcing at the same rate as anyone else. So now, when, as you pointed out before, they were just kind of the odd man out, it's not so much that anymore. And I wrote this book specifically to help people in that situation figure out where they stand with the church, but also to help non-divorced Catholics understand what they're going through and how to reach out to them.
Well, you yourself have been married and divorced. You're Catholic, of course, and you went through the annulment process, and you were remarried in the church. Now, a lot of divorced Catholics think that that annulment process is kind of a daunting thing, is it?
You know, it can be, but I think if you go into, you know, the annulment process with the attitude of, this is going to help me face my past and lay it to rest and open up my future. And, you know, through it, I'm going to understand what God has in store for me next. And if you go into it with that instead of kind of the demand that, you know, the church needs to grant this for you so you can get remarried, you will experience a lot of cleansing, healing, peace. And that is priceless. It's something everybody needs to have before they consider getting married again, or at least even getting into a relationship, because you don't want to bring a heart that's heavy with resentment and anger and all that into a new relationship. And you want to know that you are free to do so as well.
Well, it's a process of sweeping away a lot of cobwebs that may have collected over the years as well, right?
Oh, definitely. You know, in my personal experience, it was very difficult to revisit these details, the bad memories and things. But that was what really helped me grow spiritually, understand the choices that I needed to make better choices going forward. And it did definitely allow me to put that episode of my life to rest. And sometimes it may also seem daunting because you have to engage other people who knew you and your ex-spouse
right. In
this process. You have to get their testimony. And at first that might seem threatening, but, you know, I think that all these things together, when you are able to provide the tribunal with a really good picture of what happened, it just helps them make an accurate decision on, you know, what happened. So it's a good thing.
Well, now you've been ministering in one way or another to divorced Catholics for more than 20 years, I understand. What are some of the most common states of being that these folks are in immediately following their divorces and also in the weeks and months after? They're confused, at least, I imagine.
Yeah, Pat, that's a great question, and we could probably go on for a few days on that one. But suffice it to say that, especially for a Catholic who doesn't want the divorce and is forced into it anyway, and there are so many Catholics, very, very good Catholics, as well as, you know, just kind of the nominal Catholics, that end up in that situation. They fought for their marriage, but in the end, the state laws went out and you're just divorced. So that is a real shocker. If you have children, you're suddenly, you know, have all these ideas, well, what happens to my children, and how do I explain to them what their father or their mother is now doing? I'd say the first couple of months, at least, you're just learning how to sit up in the morning, you know, get out of bed, put 2 feet on the floor, breathe, and pull yourself together to face the day. That's really what those first few months are like. And then, you know, for a period of a year or so, it's really coming to grips with this new normal that you didn't want. And how, you know, how do I relate to people now that I'm divorced? And where do I fit in the church? And can I receive the sacraments? It's just a great period of questioning. And then as you go forth, then it's rebuilding. You kind of have your bearings back and you're trying to rebuild.
Well, Pope Francis has done so much in such a short time to alter the image that some people have of the church as an institution that reflexively says no. I imagine that this is a battle that you're fighting as well when you're dealing with divorced Catholics, because I imagine a lot of them are thinking, okay, I'm in a position now that the church probably didn't want me to be in, ideally, and I'm going to encounter resistance wherever I go. But they really are not, are they?
No, and I think what's important, very important for people to understand is a lot of the things that Pope Francis has done and said in regards to divorced Catholics is not condoning the action of divorce. It's asking people to understand and be merciful. And that, there's a huge difference. Now, you know, setting aside the issue of some of the bishops who want to relax the regulations or the rules for divorced and civilly remarried Catholics to receive communion, we're going to set that aside because that hasn't been addressed really fully yet. But everything else that Pope Francis is doing is trying to get people to see that there are hurting Catholics out there, and we need to be those workers to go out and find these very hurting people and bring them back to the church where they can be healed. So I really believe his call has been for us to be merciful and compassionate, not condoning, but helpful and, you know, bringing these Catholics back.
And again, a lot of these people have probably been thinking to themselves that, okay, I'm Catholic, I'm divorced, that's pretty much it for me. I don't get to have a do-over. There is no way that I am going to have love in my life again. But that is not true either, is it?
That's true, or you are correct, I should say, to clarify. And I was one of those people myself. When it happened to me, I was living in the L.A. area, and it was just a done deal. I was a traditional cradle Catholic, and I was divorced, period. So I really felt that there was no future for me. I knew very little about the annulment process, and what I did know was actually rather confusing. So it took a while, but you know, the thing is, I lost 3 children in miscarriage leading up to my failed marriage.
Oh, dear.
And I also had surgery to correct the problem, but the surgery rendered me sterile. So at 30 years old, I was divorced, no children, didn't have the hope of having children, and I was very angry. So I was that person that you just described. But 22 years later now, I am remarried in the church. I have 3 beautiful miracle children, and I never had to take any type of fertility, anything, to have those children. So that's a great point that you bring up, Pat, because God has plans. Divorce does not mean the end. It's something terrible that happened, but there is a good future for you, a great future, because God loves you, and he wants to give it to you.
Well, in the couple of minutes we have left, I'd like to explore this. You identify 5 essential characteristics of spiritually healthy people in the course of your book. What are those characteristics, and how do they contribute to a person's ability to move beyond divorce and into a future of healthy relationships?
Well, I believe the first attraction factor, as you are pointing out, is to be available. And we touched on it a little bit earlier. You want to know that you're available to love someone. You don't want to get into a relationship and find out, first of all, oh my gosh, my heart is not ready for this. I still have feelings for my ex-spouse. Or, you know, if you're so angry and wrapped up in retribution and sometimes hatred, you can't really love someone if your heart is occupied in that way. So you want to make sure that your heart is ready, and you also want to make sure that you have a decree of nullity which says that you're free to date. Then you want to learn to be a good communicator. You want to forget about those bad habits that you picked up during the divorce when you were likely having many heated arguments and all kinds of bad habits that we pick up when a marriage is failing. So you want to make sure that you've divested yourself of that and grown into good communication habits. I'm trying to think of what my other ones were because I just get carried away with these.
It's okay. We've got about a half a minute left here. I hate to cut it a little bit short. You're just going to have to buy the book and find out the rest of this stuff. Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and for shining some very welcome light into an area where a good number of Catholics have probably been uncertain in their lives. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much again. I do appreciate being here.
Well, once again, the book is The Catholic Guide to Dating After Divorce by Lisa Duffy. It's published by Ave Maria Press. When we come back, we're going to stay on the subject of marriage and talk about something called the Marriage Reality Movement that's going to be launched in September at the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia. Please stay with us.
Faustina, messenger of divine worship, comes to the Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus beginning on August the 21st. This live, multimedia drama, performed by Maria Vargo and directed by Leonardo DeFilippis, is an amazing look into the spiritual life and strength of faith of St. Faustina. For tickets and more information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.
Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. Joining us on the phone is Bill May, the president of Catholics for the Common Good. This organization is a lay apostolate for the evangelization of culture based on the social teachings of the church with particular insights from St. John Paul II. One of the ways CCG is planning to evangelize in the near future is by introducing the Marriage Reality Movement in September at the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia. Now, in a nutshell, this movement is about defining marriage as, and I'm quoting from the movement's mission statement now, the institution that not only unites a man and woman with each other, but with any children born from their union. Bill, thanks very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's so good to be with you, Patrick.
Well, is this movement a direct response, now the Marriage Reality Movement, is it a direct response to the recent ruling on same-sex marriage by the Supreme Court, or has this been something that's been in the pipeline for some time?
Patrick, we've been working on this for the last 8 years, and it all started with a recognition back in 2006, 2007, that we were on a losing path. And I discussed this with the executive director of the California Catholic Conference and told him that we needed a whole new strategy. We needed to start all over again because of the problem that hardly anybody knows what marriage is today. So this is the way we have been supporting and advocating marriage over the last many years. But really, now that marriage has been redefined by the Supreme Court, we have a clear path and a clear plan of where we go from here.
Well, this is not a movement only within the Catholic Church, is it? It's much broader.
It's for everybody. And the big problem that we have right now is that there's not a clear recognition of what just happened by the Supreme Court. Most people think that what the Supreme Court did was make it legal for same-sex couples to marry, and indeed that is a consequence. But in the process of doing it, they eliminated the only institution that unites kids with their moms and dads from the law, and that has consequences. When you understand that, you recognize that now the whole marriage issue has moved from the legislatures and the courts to the local school board. And that's where the battle is going to be fought. And really, Catholic parents, all parents, are really not prepared for this.
What is going to happen, do you believe, in the weeks and months ahead with regard to that? What are we going to be seeing?
Well, when you recognize that they've eliminated the only institution that unites kids with their moms and dads, marriage has been separated from its reality, and it becomes illegal or discriminatory to claim that there is any unique value in men and women marrying before having children. So children will have to be taught, in fact, they're already being taught in many public schools, that there is no relationship between marriage and children and family. It's a lifestyle choice for adults. They're also being taught and will be taught even more that when we have more families with children deprived of married mothers and fathers, that's a good thing. And this is not the kind of thing that we want our kids to learn, because today young people have lost the sense of what marriage is, and even with Catholic parents, I'm hearing from them that daughters saying, "Mom, why do I need to get married? I don't need to be married to have children." So, you know, nobody wants their children to grow up to be single parents. Nobody wants their grandchildren to be deprived of married mothers and fathers. But this has really been the agenda all along. It's not merely about same-sex couples. In fact, it has nothing to do with same-sex couples. It's really about redefining what marriage is in a way that makes it a lifestyle choice for adults and creating a new right, which children will be taught, a right to develop a family, you know, in any configuration that they want, by any means that they want.
Well, your website says that the movement is not a political one, that it's not about winning a public policy debate. How is the word getting out with that in mind? Is the intention that it be a grassroots effort and generally off political radar?
It's not intentionally off political radar. In fact, we've got to be engaged politically. But really, this movement is modeled after the advice that St. John Paul II gave to Solidarity back in Poland, which ultimately toppled communism. And if Solidarity can topple communism, we can certainly take back marriage. And really, what the whole focus is being in solidarity with, rather than being against, solidarity with the victims, the poor, the vulnerable, just like the pro-life movement. We're in solidarity with the right, and the church teaches it's a fundamental human right for a child, as far as possible, to be born into a family with their moms and dads united in marriage. It's also a human right that our children be able to discover the truth about love and sexuality and marriage and family, because that affects the choices they make in their own life and contributes to their own flourishing. So really, we're not against anyone or anything, as St. John Paul II told Solidarity. We're really about uplifting the person, the family, and all of humanity. So this takes, you know, a course of study and reflection. And really, what we're recommending is to prepare for dealing with these issues in the school and really to prepare better for dealing with these subjects in the family, because really this whole issue has been dividing families, dividing children from their parents. And we've got to learn new ways to witness the truth about marriage in a way that our own children can really understand the goodness and beauty of it. And we've got techniques for doing that. But we are also encouraging people to recognize that we're kind of in a cultural occupation right now. We're being occupied, essentially, and we need to, you know, form little support groups, you know, where we can study, reflect, and deal with the kinds of problems that we're going to have in increasing numbers, problems in the workplace, problems in the family, and problems in dealing with our local school boards and teachers and curricula and things of that sort. So that's the way it starts. And the reason it's not political right now is the issue is over, you know, in terms of the quote-unquote same-sex marriage. And it's not a legislative issue. It's not a court issue. But really what people need to recognize that it is a local school issue. And it's still an issue in our own family. So this is very, very exciting. I'm doing seminars and for priests around the country and lectures, and we just encourage everyone to sign up at takebackmarriage.org, takebackmarriage.org, to stay informed. We did a soft launch, by the way, back in January when our six-part series, Evangelizing the Culture for Marriage, was running on EWTN.
Well, what sort of support have you received for the movement, both within and without the church? Is the movement gaining traction with other faith traditions and with people in general?
We're really not targeting other faith traditions right now because this is all based on Catholic teaching. And really, Catholics are a cross-section of society. We have every ethnicity, every economic group, every race. And so really we're starting with Catholics, but there is a lot of interest by others. And everybody's welcome on this. It's not just for Catholics because it's really learning to witness the truth from Scripture about what marriage is in a way that people can understand it. It's really a choice of a man and woman to make themselves irreplaceable to each other. And that's what prepares them to receive a child as a gift, because in reality, the mom and dad are irreplaceable to the child, and the child is irreplaceable to the mom and dad. It's the marriage that starts the circle of irreplaceability that we call the family.
Well, in about the minute we have left, tell us about this. What are people going to see and hear in Philadelphia with regard to the movement? How are you going to present the movement in a large forum there for the first time? What are people going to see and hear?
We're not going to present it in a large forum. We're going to be meeting with Catholic organizations that are focused on family from around the country and possibly around the world. Really, this is not a program, so to speak. It's a coalition of like-minded people who have a perspective of looking at marriage through the eyes of the child and really want to defend the right of our children to discover the truth about love and marriage and family, and also to defend the right of children as far as possible to be born into a family with their mom and dad united in marriage. Once we have those objectives, then everybody can contribute creatively on how to accomplish that. There's a role in this for every ministry, for every faith-sharing group, for every organization, as long as we're focused on clear objectives, just like the pro-life movement.
Well, Bill May, thanks on behalf of all our listeners for being with us today and giving us a preview of the marriage reality movement, which we are sure to be hearing much more about come September, and the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia. When we come back, we'll be visiting with an author from London who's going to talk with us about pro-life feminism. Please stay with us.
The world-class drama series continues this summer at Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. You heard right, world-class drama through a partnership with the Diocese of Orange and St. Luke Productions. If you've yet to experience seeing a show at the Freed Theater inside Christ Cathedral's Cultural Center, you are in for a rare treat. Mark your calendars for August 21st as the 2015-16 drama series kicks off with Faustina, backed by popular demand. You can purchase your tickets now by visiting our website, ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. But don't delay. We don't want you to miss out. Share with family and friends, co-workers and neighbors. The drama series supports the vision of our diocese to share the cathedral with all faiths. Once again, the amazing faith-infusing drama Faustina returns to the Freed Theater on the campus of Christ Cathedral on August 21st. For more, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.
Welcome back. On the phone with us from London is Fiorella Nash, an author and speaker who is going to be delivering the closing keynote address of the Catholic Association of Natural Family Planning Conference in late August in San Francisco. Her subject is going to be A Path Worth Walking, Life, Liberty, and the Rise of Pro-Life Feminism. Fiorella is also a researcher for the UK-based Society for the Protection of Unborn Children and specializes in bioethics from a feminist perspective. She's also an award-winning novelist writing under the name Fiorella De Maria. And her fifth novel, We'll Never Tell Them, that's the title, We'll Never Tell Them, is scheduled to be published published this fall by Ignatius Press. It's about motherhood, marriage, and family life, and a crisis pregnancy. Fiorella, welcome, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
Well, pro-life feminism sounds to some ears like a contradiction. Tell us why it's not.
Yes, I would have thought it was a contradiction for many years. Really, pro-life feminism is very different to what most people imagine when they think of feminism. You'll probably be aware of John Paul II many years ago coining the expression, the need for a new feminism.
Yes.
And in many ways, pro-life feminism fits into that. It's about really believing in women, about equality for women, empowerment of women, education for women, but with a pro-life perspective, saying that, you know, we should believe in the sanctity of life. It's accepting the scientific reality that life begins from conception and that we should be protecting all human life. If we really believe in equality, we should be protecting all human life right from the beginning.
The equality extending to everyone, everywhere, every age, even unborn, not only to a certain population, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, give us a little bit of a preview of your address coming up next month in San Francisco. I want to read the title of it again. A Path Worth Walking, Life, Liberty, and the Rise of Pro-Life Feminism. You're taking the second part of that almost from the Declaration of Independence for the U.S., Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. But we got Life, Liberty, and the Rise of Pro-Life Feminism. What are you going to be talking about in San Francisco?
Covering a number of issues. Obviously, the conference itself is focusing a lot on NFP, and I will be talking about natural fertility appreciation from a pro-life feminist perspective, why I think it's liberating for women to know about their fertility, and also why I think artificial contraception is not liberating for women, which pits me against the vast majority of feminists. But I will also be looking at the life issues more broadly. I'll be looking at the way women are not given full information about abortion, for example, and about their fertility. And I'll be looking at the way women's fertility is abused and really putting the case for pro-life feminism and why I think this is a path worth walking.
Talking about natural family planning for a moment, is getting out the message about natural family planning an uphill battle these days in a culture in which so many people who identify as Catholic also commonly practice artificial birth control?
Yes, it's an interesting situation. In some ways, it's very, very difficult because really, contraception is so ubiquitous in our culture, it's just completely expected that women will use it. When you go and see your doctor, the first question they ask you is, what method are you using? It's just, it's sort of become part of the backdrop of daily life in a way that it wasn't 30, 40, and 50 years ago. However, I think there has been some progress among my generation and the younger generation, partly because of the green movement, in fact, women not wanting to have to take the pill, not wanting to use drugs and devices because of side effects, because of concerns about the environment, wanting a more natural approach. And so looking into NFP with fresh eyes, without some of the baggage perhaps the previous generations had about it. So there has been an increase in couples using NFP, not necessarily because they're Catholic and not necessarily for religious reasons. But as you say, a lot of practicing Catholics do use contraception, that there's still an awful lot of misinformation. So the first thing you have to try to get through is all the myths, all the ideas, the fixed ideas people have about Vatican roulette and all things you'll be familiar with, to say this is reliable, it's user-friendly, and it's good for marriage, and it's good for women.
That's one thing I think a lot of NFP advocates do have to overcome, as you just mentioned, the idea that people have fixed in their minds about the old idea of Vatican roulette that goes all the way back to, oh gosh, the 60s and beyond. It is not the same thing today. Natural family planning is not the same thing as it was many, many years ago.
No, not at all. And of course, I find that is almost one of the easier misconceptions to shift as soon as you start talking to people and you say, well, you know, the rhythm method, it's over 50 years old. There's been a huge amount of advance in our understanding of fertility since then. And when I start to talk about, you know, the natural method I use and the many different methods that are available, people start to think a little bit more deeply about it. But it's one of those bits of received wisdom that people very rarely question unless they're called to question it. So that's what we're really having to do, is to start by saying, hang on a second, do you really know what NFP is? Let me tell you a bit more about it.
Yeah, you almost have to get up in people's faces a little bit in a public place, in this case, in the conference in San Francisco, where it is more public and will be more widely reported.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has to be done in a public place. We have to try to get the message out there as widely as possible. But a lot of the work is also done on a one-to-one basis. It's those little conversations with your friends, with other mothers at baby and toddler groups. It's even talking to your own doctor. Very few members of the medical profession know very much about NFP, and they're the people at the coalface, they're the people at the front line. If they don't know about it, they can't tell their patients about it. So it's a huge battle, but one I'm quite optimistic about.
Well, back to the San Francisco conference for just a moment. Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco is scheduled to deliver the opening keynote address. You're delivering the closing one. And he's going to talk about stewardship of our bodies. Now, what does that mean to the average Catholic and to the average, particularly the average married Catholic? Stewardship of our bodies. How would you define that?
Well, I think most Catholics would be quite bemused by the expression, but it's very important, particularly for married couples, as a concept. I suppose with the development of the theology of the body, maybe we'd say stewardship of the body, it's that the body is important, first and foremost, that, you know, we are made in the image and likeness of God. So what you do to your body and the way you express yourself physically, sexually, spiritually, is all very significant. So you can't say that these things don't matter. And when you understand that, the idea of the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit and all of that, you maybe start to take your actions a little bit more seriously. And, of course, within marriage, that's where NFP comes in, you know, the importance of sexuality and the importance of fertility, and fertility being at the center of every conversation.
Do you think that many Catholics, particularly traditional Catholics, when they hear about the theology of the body, do you think it makes them a little bit uncomfortable, possibly? A lot of traditional Catholics, I imagine, separate their idea of faith into two parts. They think of the soul and the body, and when they think of the soul, they think, oh, this is the province of my religion, the province of my faith. The body, this is just what I walk around in every day, and it doesn't matter that much. They don't link it necessarily to the practice of their faith, but this is not the way that newer Catholics or more enlightened Catholics are thinking about it, are they?
Well, unfortunately, I think a lot of people, non-Catholics, atheists, see things that way, to have this kind of dualism when it comes to, you know, the physical and the spiritual, or just see things in terms of the physical if they don't believe in the spiritual. But that's not what Christianity is about. If you think about it, the incarnation is a reality. You know, God became man. So for that reason, we can never see the physical as unimportant. I remember a priest once really startling me during a talk saying, fertility is important because the church came into being in the fallopian tube of a woman.
Now that
think
is
about it.
Now that is something that it cuts to the core of things right there.
Yeah, it's an amazing, very profound thought that if we believe in the incarnation, we simply cannot avoid the importance of the physical and the link between the physical and the spiritual.
Well, in the minute we have left here, your novels reflect your views on this subject to a degree. Tell us a bit about your latest novel, We'll Never Tell Them. It takes place over a fair arc of time, as I understand it.
Yes, the climax, as it were, is during the First World War, but it's really about the generation of women who reached adulthood in time for the First World War. So they saw their lovers and their husbands go off to the war, and then, of course, their sons during the Second World War also going off to fight. But it's told in retrospect, so you have some of the action taking place around the time of the millennium, and then the constant switches back over a period of about 80 years. So there's a lot of comparison between the near contemporary and that terribly difficult period in the early 20th century. So it talks about, well, the role of women. The main character is a nurse during the First World War, so she has that role of caring and nurturing. But it also looks at the very quiet courage of that generation of women who witnessed so much horror and in many cases were left alone afterwards to pick up the pieces. It's a tribute to them.
Well, Fiorella Nash, thank you again for being with us today on Orange County Catholic Radio, and much good luck to you when you visit San Francisco for the Catholic Association of Natural Family Planning Conference next month.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll be speaking with Sister John Ellen Turner from St. Catherine's Academy. Please stay with us. On the phone with us is Sister John Ellen Turner. Sister John Ellen is the president of St. Catherine's Academy in Anaheim. At more than 125 years old, one of the oldest Catholic educational institutions in Southern California. Many of our listeners likely still think of it as St. Catherine's Military School and may be familiar with seeing the cadets in uniform, but St. Catherine's is much more than spit and polish, as we will hear from Sister John Ellen. Sister, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Pat, for inviting us. It's nice to be with you.
Well, you have called St. Catherine's a Catholic school with a military tradition, and it's the only K-8 school of its kind in the country. Tell us about how that balance is achieved, the Catholic school with the military tradition.
Well, Pat, it goes back to our history when we began as an all-girls school about 126 years ago now, an orphanage, and then it, in about 15 years, transferred over to an all-boys school, and there was a discipline program that was needed, and so many different things were tried, and then we had the visit of a captain from the Navy who came by and said, why don't you put some of the military tradition in? And so what we do is we take the best of the military, which is all the values that substantiate the military program and the military service, and all that the Catholic Church and Christianity teaches in virtue. So we marry up the values and the virtues, and it becomes the most wonderful program for boys, because boys need structure. Boys need to know what you expect of them. They learn much differently than girls. Their brain is wired differently than girls' brains are. So the boys want to know exactly what you want them to do. Girls, well, we don't care. We just do whatever we think. But boys want direct direction. And so that's what the values of the military program do, because they create the structure. It's all based on respect and working together in units, working together as community. So in the military, they call them companies. And in Christianity and Catholicity and in the Dominican tradition, which is what I am, we call it community. In the military, they call it service and outreach. In the Dominican way of life, we call it ministry and giving to others. Military calls it academics. Dominicans call it study or academics. And the military brings in respect, and we wrap our three areas up with the pillar of prayer. So the boys are exposed to everything that makes them a complete person. Nothing is missing. The spirituality is there, the leadership is there, the academics are there, the community and outreach is there. So that's what the two programs do. They hold hands and they walk together. And it's very unusual. It's the only one of its kind. And people get us mixed up because they say, why would anyone want to send their boys to your school? A military school is harsh and terrible. And I said, I don't know about military schools because that's not what we are. We have the military tradition. There's absolutely the only kind of discipline we have are merits and demerits and learning how to get along. There's not a bullying aspect here because we don't allow it. And the boys don't allow it because they help lead each other. So, Pat, I better stop because I could go on forever.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Well, no, we're doing just fine here. We're getting a lot of good information. There's one thing I do want to ask you here that you told me a long time ago. You've achieved another kind of balance at the school between male and female influence as well. You have the military and male staff members on one hand, and you have the Dominican sisters and female lay teachers on the other, and you found that works very well. Is that so?
It's so. It's like a mother and father. You know, the dad has to be the hard character sometimes, and the mom can be the nurturer. And so that's what we do. The boys come to, I'll just use myself, and they'll come to me and they say, "Sister, can you pray for me, sister? Can I talk to you about this?" And they won't do that with the military, but they'll go to the military and ask for advice. And that happened, if I can tell you briefly, Pat, one time with a young man who was upset he didn't receive a position he thought he deserved, and he cried and cried and cried in my office. And I said, "Well, honey, you know," and I listened to him. I gave him Kleenex, water, candy, anything else that could calm him down. And eventually, after about 10 minutes, I said, "I better go get Colonel because this is his department." And so Colonel came in. This young man stood up, stood straight, saluted Colonel, said, "Good afternoon, sir." Tears were going. They were leaving him. He sat down, and Colonel said, "Well, son, what's the matter?" And he said, "I'm sorry, Colonel, nothing." He said, no, there is something the matter." He said, "Don't you want that position that I gave you?" "Well, I do." He said, "Because you were expecting another one, but it didn't fit you. This one fits you and fits our academy. We need your gifts in this area." Now, this is to a seventh grade boy. And so the conversation lasted about a minute and a half. Colonel stood up. The cadet saluted him, shook his hand. Colonel left. The cadet walked by me and gave me a big hug and walked out. And I went to Colonel and I said, "What just happened in there?" And he said, "That's what happens. See?" He said, the two of us work so well together. The male and the female really do unite here. So that's an example of what we do.
Well, getting to the military discipline part of it for just a second.
Okay.
I remember you telling me this. The men tell the boys, as I recall, if they have to be disciplined, they say, "This isn't personal. This is professional."
Exactly.
And how does that sit with the boys?
They have to learn it because they do take it personally. All of us do. If someone gets upset with us or we make a faux pas or we fail in something, we take it in. But what the military have to learn, the different services that help, you know, protect our country, they have to learn to get over that and to go forward. So that's one of the strengths of the military. So Colonel will say, "What I think about you, young man, is different right now. It's what you're doing." And Colonel will often say to him, "I appreciate you and I respect you, but the choice you made has to be disciplined because it's professional." So it's not, we just don't throw it at them, you know, Pat. They really do grow in this. They're trained in this, and it's amazing to watch how they deal with each other when things happen. When the adult's not there, but the leadership has to take over, they will say, "Are you doing the best you can right now for the academy?"
That brings me to another question here. There's a real interdependence among the boys and a real accountability, isn't there? It's a very unique spirit among them.
Yeah, they take their leadership very seriously. And I know, and I've been principal of four other Catholic schools and loved every one of them, but that's more of like the student council leadership. This is a little bit different from that. Because what we do, the activities we do are different, marching in parades and carrying the colors, presenting the colors at different events and doing things for the bishop and the church and passing out programs at the cathedral and all kinds of things like that. But they know, the boys know, that they are responsible for their company. And so they have to call that company to be the best that it can be. And so the boys within a company call each other. So if a young man is failing in something and he's losing merits, that affects the company. So I've heard boys go to him and say, "Let me help you at study hall. I'll help you pull that grade up." Now, I haven't told him to do that. This year at graduation, one of the eighth graders that was graduating, who was the leader of a company, came up and said, "Sister, so-and-so has done so well this year. I think he deserves a promotion." And I said, "Then take it to Colonel, Captain, and Sergeant." So he did, and they respected him. They said, "Okay, if you think he deserves one, he'll get it." So there's an honor that happens among, they're taught that they're brothers and that they are for each other all the time. And I think that's what happens, why when they leave our school, they miss it so much, because there's a family of brotherhood that's been created it's all been good. It's all good choices. It's doing what is best for the other person. And they miss it because they get into situations where they say, why are they making those choices? So I get phone calls when they get into ninth grade in high school, and they say, Sister, do you know what's going on? And I said, so what are you going to do about it? And they just, one boy just stopped and he said, oh, all right. That's what we want you to do. You go out and preach through the Dominicans what is right to the world. And I said, so you have to make a statement here. And so one of them came back and he said, Sister, I did. I went to the principal and the principal put me in charge of it. And I said, and he said, it worked out, Sister. And I said, good. So we don't want something that's going to be over when they graduate. We want it to be lasting in their lifetime. And so we get, Pat, we have alumni that come back here. One that came back was 94 years old.
My goodness. He walked
through the door and he started to cry. And I was standing there and I thought, oh dear, he had a bad experience. And he stopped and he wouldn't talk. And finally he finished tears and he said, Sister, I graduated 80 years ago. He said, I'm 94 and I had to come home one more time. He said, no one will ever understand what this school does for boys.
My goodness.
And that happens a lot, but this one, because he passed away shortly after that, the boys gave him an honorary rank, and they ate lunch with him, and he was just so happy to be here. So they come back a lot. It's just such a unique place. And you know, Pat, I don't know what to do if I could stand in the middle of harbor and refuse to let cars pass until they come and see who we are. I've been tempted to do that, but I won't because it'll embarrass the sisters. But there's something to coming and visiting, you know, and just seeing what it's about. It's such a great place to be.
Well, listeners, if you happen to see a Dominican nun in the middle of Harbor Boulevard waving her arms, you will know that Sister John Ellen has finally done it. And you'd better do what she says and pay St. Catherine's a visit. Sister John Ellen Turner, many thanks for taking time out of your summer school day to be with us here on Orange County Catholic Radio.
Thanks, Pat. God bless all of you, and have a wonderful summer.
Please visit with us again soon.
I will. Thank you so much.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties, and to AM 930 in Los Angeles County. I'm Patrick Mott.